Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Verso Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF out of Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP out of Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP out of Columbus, Ohio. Archives of the show can be found a week after broadcast at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can contact us for critiques, criticisms, caterwauling, catawba, I don't know, at The Final Straw Radio at riseup.net. This week, we spoke with Tom Nomad, author of The Master's Tools, Warfare and Insurgent Possibility, and a member of the Institute for the Study of Insurgent Warfare, which recently published the first issue of Insurgencies, a Journal of Insurgent Strategy, out from Little Black Cart. Tom talks about anarchist approaches towards ethics and strategic choices, the insurrectionalist turn in North America, and the growing focus among many of the study of insurgency and counterinsurgency for the purpose of reframing our struggle against capital, the state, and other enemies. There's also brief discussions on deep green resistance, ISIS, YPD, policing, summit hopping, and much more. All this after we hear from anarchist prisoner Sean Swain.
I've given a lot of thought to the issue of the Islamic State militants. Everyone in the world seems to have an opinion on this. The general consensus is that the Islamic State is violent, brutal, oppressive, patriarchal, and sectarian. The general consensus is that they need to be stopped. Having an opinion on this seems to be the thing to do, so let me open my big mouth. Anonymous issued a statement opposed to the Islamic State back in June. They pointed out that these militants have hijacked the idea of what Islam is, excluding all who disagree with them. Anonymous deferred to a cleric who issued a fatwa against the Islamic State. I've got an issue with that. By deferring to a fatwa issued by a cleric, Anonymous is saying that it's okay for Muslims to kill Muslims who kill Muslims. This approach is exactly the problem. For decades, outside interests cheer on good Muslims to exterminate bad Muslims. And, of course, these various outside interests always find a cleric's fatwa to justify their bloodbath. I would suggest to Anonymous that we need to stop participating in that. And please don't melt down my website. Look, the emergence of the Islamic State is our collective sins of the past making up for lost time. They didn't pop up out of nowhere. These are people who grew up crawling through the rubble of U.S. extermination policy. Madeleine Albright, Clinton's Secretary of State, told them that the murder of 500,000 of their children under the age of 6 was a small price to pay for toppling some minor despot. This is a generation that lost loved ones, autonomy, and dignity to an imperial colonizer. The group's leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, spent time in U.S. custody and was released. One could only assume that his experience of Abu Ghraib-ass pyramids provoked his current resolve. Yeah, these folks are brutal, oppressive, and patriarchal. They desperately assume the same structure as their enemy in an effort to defeat that enemy. They think that to liberate themselves from the coalition of the United States and its puppets, they have to form a state to stand up to it. Everyone else is stating up, so why shouldn't they? In this regard, their only crime is being unimaginative. Newsflash. All states are brutal, oppressive, and patriarchal. Ferguson, Hong Kong, everywhere. As for the sectarian violence, killing other Muslims, they don't really have a choice.
You have 60 seconds left on this call.
Given that other Muslims are duped into serving the occupier and colonizer, militants have no other option but to eliminate the enemy within. That's one of the difficult choices they feel they have to make if they ever want a strong Islamic State that will keep their children out of the evil clutches of the Madeleine Albrights. History, it seems, is screaming at the militants to be brutal, oppressive, patriarchal, and sectarian if they want to stop the slow murder of their children by the colonizer. Given this context, while I personally deplore the death and destruction, I have a hard time denouncing others who are resisting a powerful oppressor. For me to oppose the Islamic State purge tactics would be as hypocritical as Jesse Jackson sermonizing Ferguson, urging folks to sing Kumbaya while their kids get slaughtered by militarized racist pigs. So long as I've got my hands in my pockets, who am I to tell others how to wield their rifles? So I get it. The Islamic State militants are bad. So when they've murdered even a tenth of the number of children the U.S. has exterminated, give me a call. The sad reality is, if the Islamic State is defeated, U.S. domination will throw millions out of the frying pan and into the fire. As an anarchist, I would much prefer an Islamic non-state, as proposed by anarchist Muslims in Kobani. Unfortunately, in this imperfect world, we're stuck with hierarch militants who lack imagination. If you don't like that, well, then help dismantle the United States and eliminate aspiring statists' reasons to exist. Are you down with that? Yeah, that's what I thought. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from Ohio's Supermax facility. If you're down with that, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain, number 243-205, OSP, 878, Coitsville-Hubbard Road, Youngstown, Ohio, 44505. To read some of Sean's writings and learn more about his case, check out seanswain.org. Tom Nomad is the author of The Master's Tools, Warfare and Insurgent Possibility, out from Repartee, an imprint of Little Black Cart. Tom is also involved in the Institute for the Study of Insurgent Warfare. Thanks a lot for having a conversation.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Earlier this year, you were involved in publication of Insurgencies, a journal of insurgent strategy. Can you talk about this project? What sort of intervention is it attempting?
Oddly enough, Insurgencies kind of grew out of an attempt that had been going on for probably 3 years already, sort of coming out of the recent upsurge in some demonstrations at in the kind of late 2000s. There was an attempt to start to understand a little bit more of what we were facing from not just a practical but theoretical sort of background. And we had been, probably at that time, some of us had been studying police tactics and strategy for already going on 4 years, but it sort of spread out into more methodological approaches. One of the things that tends to happen in this sort of discussion is people want a clear list of things that they should do, but in any sort of strategic situation, there's no sort of replication of any situation that's ever occurred before that. So what's more important than understanding the ways that people should respond to things is understanding what the background of those things are and ways to approach even analyzing them to begin with. And so some of us had started working on sort of strategy theory and tactics from a more sort of formal perspective, reading through, for example, the entire reading list of the U.S. Army War College's master's program and sort of working from there. And out of this, Little Black Cart contacted me about releasing a series of journals this year, right, and asked me if I wanted to do one. And so I started assembling together a more formal collective of people that had already been working on those sorts of things to sort of put this out. And so the attempt started off as a way to think through some of the impasses that we've been facing, specifically ways to think through problems of surveillance, state repression, but also ways to think through certain dichotomies that have been posed. Things like, you know, there's a tendency in anarchist circles to say that the only possible tactics are sort of mass movement tactics or kind of clandestine tactics, right? Without thinking through the nuances that may exist, without thinking through what assumptions that's making and so on. And so the idea was almost as much to form a think tank to work through those things as much as to put out a journal.
So someone, naturally, because of the leftist past and relationship that anarchism has, right, people start thinking in terms of movement building. Can you break down that idea of like what movement building is and what that dichotomy is, and maybe between movement building versus clandestine groups, and maybe why it's a false dichotomy?
Yeah, so there's this, to start off, I mean, we have to think about what we mean by the term movement, right? So we talked about this in the intro to Insurgencies, but the concept of movements is sort of a historical categorization, right? It's something that comes to express something that occurs usually later, sometimes concurrent with events, but it serves to have this sort of generalizing component to it, right? So it eliminates the sort of specificities of time and space in which engagements actually occur. And so when we start to think about things in terms of movements, right, we start to posit these kind of false relationships of unity. We start to think of historical continuities that might exist from moment to moment. And what that generates is a situation in which we are incapable of making sense of sort of the specificities of actual engagement at an actual time in an actual space, that we fail to look at what those dynamics are, and we start to think about things on the level of, like in Occupy, right, there was this problem of people starting to think about, what does an Occupy movement mean, right? We're seeing this in the recent sort of kind of initiatives and actions against police violence, in which there's all of these sort of national organizations popping up trying to start national campaigns around a situation in which, though there may be a lot of sympathy geographically across kind of geographic lines, tends to exist in very different ways in an actual material sense in different places, right? And that's usually that idea of the movement, right, as this kind of conceptual unity is usually counterposed with this concept of sort of clandestine action, right, like small groups taking actions that have a lot of magnitude, usually against symbolic targets. Right, and so the dichotomy starts to break down around sort of numerical mass, but really that's a fundamentally problematic sort of way of thinking about it, right? That what tends to happen in something like movements, right, or what we call in insurgencies activism, is this attempt to engage with sort of a symbolic enemy, right? One that is, say, a corporation or the government or the police in this like very generalized conceptual sense, which fails to allow us to recognize how things actually function in a sort of logistical sense, in a sort of immediate sense. We see the same thing in organizations like the Red Army Faction or the Weather Underground, in which there's this attempt to kind of unleash attacks against symbolic enemies, right? That you're attacking a corporation or you're attacking a draft board to attempt to impact the military, right, or something like that. But there wasn't this attempt at actually impacting the logistical operation of state forces in a very immediate sense, right? And so really what we're positing is that the real difference isn't between sort of clandestinity and mass movements. The real difference has to do with the difference between symbolic engagement and strategic engagement or material engagement in this very immediate sense.
Yeah, the introduction to insurgencies I thought was pretty interesting. Can you break down the postulates that are in that? There were nine of them, right?
Yeah, there were nine. I don't have a copy in front of me.
It's okay if you can't do it right off the top of your head. That's fine.
Generally, what the attempt is to do is to start the conversation from a different, again, different sort of series of categories, right? So we're moving beyond this idea of activism, right? Critiquing this concept of activism. So activism, as we define it, is based in sort of two different kind of fundamental premises and a series of sub-premises, right? That these premises begin from an almost ethical injunction to engage discursively, right? So you decide that something is unjust, right? You decide that there's some sort of ethical problem with the thing. And so you are being called upon at that point within the context of activism to do something about it, right? Those things tend to be sort of displaced, right? We saw a lot of that during the anti-war movement or even during Occupy, where people would sit there with signs on street corners trying to complain about something that in a very immediate sense was happening very far away without really attempting to impact that at all. And that engagement starts to break down into this sort of symbolic discursive engagement with a symbolic enemy, right? We see a lot of this. I mean, we're seeing a lot of this now in the movement, kind of movements and initiatives against police violence, right? This kind of attempt to take action against police violence has started to break down into some people attempting to take sort of symbolic actions against police violence, right? To sort of encourage people to like watch the police or like stand witness or to encourage people to sort of march around. I mean, we've been seeing a lot of this where I'm at with Revolutionary Communist Party based front organizations, things like that. They want people to kind of march around aimlessly after rush hour, those kinds of things. But what happens in that sense is that there's not this attempt to kind of make sense of the police in some like fundamental way, to understand how they operate, to understand where they are, when their shift changes are, how they do things, right? And what that means is that the terrain of engagement gets displaced from itself. There's still this an engagement with the police, for example, right, in direct actions and so on. There's still an engagement with the police, but there's very little understanding of how that actually functions, why decisions are being made the way they are, ways to circumvent those activities. There's just this sort of tendency to, for example, come up to a police line and just yell at the police, for example, rather than to try and figure out how they're actually functioning in a space. And what this breaks down to is this kind of sub-premise that we talk about, in which engagement within activism becomes a question of not just a sort of ethical imperative, but also becomes premised on passion, right? That you engage from a position of passion or motivation, rather than from a position of strategic imperative. And so there tend to be things like kind of interpersonal problems tend to become breaking points as to whether someone will work with someone else, right? That this becomes a question of friendship rather than a question of strategic imperative, right? Or in sort of the planning of actions, people tend to try and make the biggest discursive statement. There's a lot of focus. You see this in anyone that's ever gone to a training done by Training for Change, right? There's this focus on symbolism and feelings and, you know, the visual presence that you have in the space, rather than an actual material focus on actual engagement, right? What that means, what the structures behind the logistics of the police are, how those function in a very immediate sense. And so the critique of activism is more a critique of the kind of symbology of discursive engagement than a critique of, say, pacifism or nonviolence or something like that, which, you know, within the collective we have plenty of critiques of ourselves, but which isn't specifically the point that we want to start from, right? That the question at that point after the introduction becomes, what is the most effective action? And to understand that means to understand the actual terrain of engagement in a very immediate material sense, right? And with that, the point and the attempt is to kind of reframe the conversation around that question, not around the question of, say, abstract tactics talked about in abstract ways, right? You run into all these people talking about strategic nonviolence, but there can be no such thing in a very basic sense, that to claim that one can talk about strategy while also setting sort of meta-ethical limitations on the possibility of that discussion is fundamentally a paradox. And so the question becomes, first of all, what's the most effective action? And then secondly, what actions are people willing to take, which might not be everything, but we have to understand that as a limitation. So we have to start from a different place, and that place has to be a place of actual material engagement that exists separately from kind of political discourse.
So keeping on the subject of police, one of the articles in the journal talks at length about what the police are and also how anarchists often view themselves in relation to the police and criminality.
Yeah.
Can you talk about some of the limitations that we put on ourselves in terms of how we subjectify ourselves and maybe more realistically how the state operates in terms of us?
So the article specifically was an attempt to think around the problems of sort of security culture, right? Security culture being this more or less series of rules that tends to get posited as far as how people are supposed to stay safe. But in that, what we do is we tend to think of the police as this kind of identifiable and outside force, right? This thing that we can always see coming and in which we tend to engage with only at points of sort of immediate contact, right? Rather than understanding them as a terrain, right? Both as a force which constructs terrain, right? So we see this in things like the proliferation of security cameras, that the terrain of surveillance has increased dramatically. But not only does that allow them to see more, it also posits some very functional limitations in their ability to actually process footage, for example. There's too much to watch, right? So keeping those sorts of things in mind. And when we tend to think about our engagement with the police, we tend to think about it in this very general way. There was a scare recently around the Cleveland area in which people were talking about the police having acquired stingrays, which are these sort of computers that can disrupt cell phone reception and even pick off calls in midair and so on. And so, of course, every single phone call that got dropped all of a sudden was a result of that. Every single white van became a surveillance van, right? And so there was this thinking about, well, okay, we're doing this thing. We're not taking precautions in relation to this thing. But here's this thing that we think the police are doing, so now we're going to start taking precautions. What we're arguing is that we have to understand the police as an operation, something which happens constantly, right? Something which is always sort of in motion, but as one which is also consequently partial. And so in that process, the partiality lends an air of arbitrariness to things, right? That it's not that the police are always there, but it's that they can be. And so in every single scenario that we engage in, we have to think of that as a potential hazard, right? As something which we can take steps before actual contact occurs in order to mitigate, right? And so what becomes very important about that there are things like it ceases being a question of whether you give total information to somebody. You never actually do so. We're always sort of engaging in performance. We're always giving our interpretations of things to people, right? There's no way to actually, for example, completely tell the truth. We're always sort of framing those things. And so with that recognition, it always becomes this question of in what way are we giving what information to what people in what situations? What way are we dressing in what situation in relation to what other series of dynamics, right? That we can't think of security and security culture, our engagement with the police, specifically on the level of just our own personal practices in isolation. But what it has to do with is fundamentally the way that we relate to our space, that which exists around us, and the way that we take the recognition of performativity, of the way that we perform information, the way that we perform the giving of information, and use that as a way to think about how we interact with our space and people within that space on a consistent basis. That the methodology actually comes from construction workers on a construction site. If you're walking around a construction site and you see a nail sticking up, you don't wait for someone to step on the nail before you, you know, hammer the nail back in. You like take 30 seconds and hammer the nail back in. You construct the entire situation around you in a way to prevent hazard. And what we're suggesting is that in order for us to engage effectively, we have to be doing the same thing.
At a few points in your writings and interviews, you've talked about the need to separate the means from the ends in terms of how, as anarchists, we live our lives and engage in struggle. For many anarchists, however, the ends and the means are viewed as needing to be the same, meaning that we engage our ethics to create the world we want to see. Would you talk about this and what implications that conclusions are?
Yeah, so there's sort of two fundamental limitations that exist within this understanding of kind of living our ideals. And the first has to do with a more sort of base philosophical problem with this idea, right? So we sort of have these concepts of what we want the world to look like or be or something like that. And we have these in this very general kind of aspatial, atemporal sort of sense, right? That no concept is specific to the sort of moment that the concept's being thought in. We kind of construct ways of thinking, but they're in a sense a kind of conceptual way of attempting to make sense of something. That, in other words, our ethics never actually speak of the world. Our thought never actually speaks of the world. It's merely a process of trying to make sense of things, right? But to think about thought as a full expression of the world is to consequently attempt to construct a new language every single moment at the point where every single thing changes in every single moment, right? So we can't actually do that. We can't have some sort of ethical or political truth that actually expresses much of anything about the world except how we're making sense of things. That's more of a formal point. The fundamental problem becomes that, as my graduate school advisor used to always say, to think about some sort of future after the revolution kind of world is to think about a space that exists after a series of events that are so completely catastrophic that the categories that we use to make sense of life right now are no longer relevant, right? We can't think of what will a life after wage labor look like. We can't think of what occurs when the police are off the streets, right? We can attempt to fantasize about these things, right? Kropotkin writes fantastic books of political fiction. But to think that we can actually understand that is farcical, right? It's not a relevant thing to obsess over. And in that process of attempting to obsess over these sorts of things, what we do is we fundamentally limit our ability to look at what's going on currently right now, right? And this creates all sorts of strategic and tactical problems. For example, we tend to think about what our ethics in the future should be. And what that does is it fundamentally prevents us from doing some things which right now might be fundamentally effective because we don't want to, you know, construct some dynamic that might carry on into the world in the future or something like that. And so though we can attempt to process through the effects of our actions, for example, we can't actually know what those are, right? We can attempt to project those. We can attempt to predict those. But we can't actually know, for example, what will occur between now and some future moments, all of the dynamics that will be involved in generating some sort of effect at some future moment, what will happen after that moment, and so on. That becomes a philosophical problem on its base level, on its formal level. But in a very basic way, it fundamentally constrains our ability to think about what we can do now, right? That people like to think that, and again, I've run into plenty of people in the recent past that have been doing this, like to think that we can just engage in this way that's positive and affirming within the context of warfare, right? It's the same sort of mentality that, you know, generates an approach to, say, police violence, which just asks the police to be less violent, right? In other words, to be less effective police, without recognizing that force is fundamentally the very means of existence, the mode of existence of policing itself, right? And so in that engagement, we have to think about, on a more fundamental level, what are we doing and what are our objectives? Where are we trying to get? And those objectives have to be thought in a very immediate sense rather than in this sort of utopian, after some very serious, significant thing changes sort of way, which is based in attempting to project a situation that we can't possibly understand.
But what you're saying there is not necessarily that prefigurative projects can't occur, right?
Right. It's just that they're based in a kind of mythology. Fundamentally.
Sure.
Right.
But if you're talking about, say, you know, creating infrastructure, which was something that was brought up mm-hmm. in a bunch in the conversation that you had with Doug on Free Radical Radio, really good interview folks should listen to. There was a talk about creating, like, oh, God, what's the Tikkunis phrase? I guess, like, building the party or whatever.
right.
You know, and sort of not necessarily just going to your wage job on a regular basis, but trying to save some of that and like build infrastructure and stuff that would take care of each other in the meantime, right?
Yes and no. I mean, so where I tend to separate this from prefigurative projects is prefigurative projects tend to be projects which attempt to manifest some sort of end of history, right? Some sort of end point that they think that the means in which something is constructed now necessarily leads to something later. When I'm talking about infrastructure, I'm talking about something that's fundamentally different in a very basic way, in that infrastructure exists in order to create the possibility of struggle, not meant to necessarily persist. If it does, it'd be interesting, but it's not meant to do so. So, for example, like building up computer skills, right? Learning how to aim, things like that. I mean, they're not skills that many of us would want to build up in some sort of perfect world, right? Sitting in front of a computer for hours, hacking away at something, or, you know, thinking about how to effectively use weapons or learn how to fight is not something that we would generally want to be doing. But building up the infrastructure that allows us to do so allows us to actually be able to think about engaging effectively. Right now, we're in a position in which we often engage at disadvantage almost on a universal basis, engage at a point of disadvantage, right? That to think about, and this was kind of the failure of the insurrectionist project, which I think a lot of us were part of, was always this focus on the next immediate fight, right? Rather than the means in which that immediate fight can occur with, right? And that started to change towards the end. But fundamentally, the failure became this kind of mythology of total deployment, of going out, just deploying all of your assets at one thing, and then seeing what happens, and then building up again, then deploying everything at one thing, and seeing what happens, and building up again, just running that cycle over and over and over again. So when I'm talking about infrastructure, I'm kind of cutting a line in between these two things, between kind of prefiguration, which is an attempt to sort of predict the future materially, and this kind of complete lack of any thought of implication, strategic futurity, things like that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. More from our conversation with author and strategist Tom Nomad about insurgent warfare after this brief musical break.
Late this morning, I heard the rifles. Bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao. Late this morning, I heard the rifles, and it is time for me to go. The fairest flower in all the mountains. Bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao. The fairest flower in all the mountains is the black rose that sets us free. We will join her and fight together. Bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao. We will join her and fight together, or we will surely die alone. The winter's coming, the snows are on us. Bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao. The winter's coming, the snows are on us. Now we must fill the fires of our own.
You're listening to The Final Straw on AshevilleFM.org. Back to our conversation with Tom Nomad of the Institute for the Study of Insurgent Warfare. Well, you talk about the Insurrectional Project as a thing that's past. Can you talk about that and where you think? Do you think that insurgent thought and the studying of counterinsurgency and things like this are the main tendency in American or North American anarchism at this point?
It's hard to think of the Insurrectional Project as having passed, right? Even though I talk about it that way all the time, and that's mostly, I think, because of my own sort of involvement in that. What's passed is, again, this kind of tendency towards immediate engagement, right? They talked about this in Op-Tot, which was another Little Black Heart journal. One of the things that happened in the Insurrectional kind of project was the question became a question of the magnitude of engagement. Engaging the hardest, you know, breaking the most stuff, so on, so on, so on, and jumping from like point of confrontation to point of confrontation. And never really sitting there and actually reconfiguring the terrain in which those confrontations occur in, right? This is why known insurgencies, we talk about, like, though activism might be a failed methodology on the whole, it's not necessarily always necessarily ineffective to engage in it or not engage in it, right? But sometimes those means might be the most effective means, though we have to consequently recognize them as farcical. I think one of the things that happened with the kind of Insurrectional Project was an inability to think beyond the sort of tactics that were being utilized, and just an inability to think towards this kind of tendency towards strategic effectiveness. That the discourse broke down into discussions of revolutionary subjectivity and sort of discussions of the self and desire and so on, so on, so on. And all of those are fine, but what stopped happening on the street was a focus on effectiveness. It started becoming more and more about fulfillment. And that's where it fundamentally kind of collapsed. What's going on now, I think this is interesting, is there is more of a focus on kind of insurgency and counterinsurgency within North American anarchist thought, but only to a certain degree, and seemingly, and granted I'm pretty isolated up in Northern Ohio, but seemingly only amongst a certain set of people. Generally people that have already been around for a little while, and people that had been through, at least directly or maybe even mildly indirectly through repression, this kind of attempt to make sense of what happened and ways to actually circumvent that. And there's something very promising within that discussion. I think what's tended to happen, though, within that discussion so far, is that you look at the BAK press reader, I forget the name of it off the top of my head.
Life During Wartime?
Yes. You look at that reader, and some of the pieces are very good. Some of the pieces are attempts to kind of ethically or politically read counterinsurgency. And that's not a fundamentally important thing for us to be doing. It's not a question of whether counterinsurgency is good or bad. It's a question of how it functions, what its methodologies are. And that requires a lot of study that I think a lot of the people that have been sort of writing on this so far, or at least some of them, haven't done. Others have. Christian Williams does very good work on those. But even in a lot of his work, and I mean, I love a lot of the stuff he's done, but there's still this tendency to try and say, and you see this in Our Enemies in Blue, for example, to try and say, here's this thing that happened here at this one point. Here's this thing that happened here at this other point. Here's this kind of loose historical narrative that we can draw between the two. And though that can be important in allowing us to kind of develop a framework through which we can start to make sense of some of this stuff, it also requires an actual immediate analysis of things in a time and place. And that's something I haven't seen a lot of yet. I think the closest that we've gotten to that so far is actually the police movement's Twitter during G20, 2009. It was a spectacular attempt to actually give information to people that would allow them to change the trajectories of what they were doing in real time. And that's where this kind of work becomes very important.
That sort of thing was happening also in 2005, I think, in the Mission District in San Francisco, when there was a counter protest to police, or not to police, like a kind of poorly planned counter protest to the G20 or G8 that was going on in Scotland at the same time. That's interesting. It's interesting to see how people are using the technology to, you know, the same sort of kind of technologies that the police and the military are using to counter the movements until the police find out that we're using those same technologies. But
it does require, well, and it requires, like, during G20, the police movement's Twitter got taken down like 3 times. It kept shifting, kept changing, right? Like, the where you'd have to go to get the information would be different. And that's okay. But I think one of the things that has to be developed is, and this is kind of the fallacy in the whole crime thing, what is it, like evacuating the techno-utopia piece, is this complete lack of recognition of what the use of basic usable technologies can give us in a strategic sense. Being able to trade information securely, which is something that there isn't a ton of an ability to do except through the use of encryption so far, can give us a major advantage in the future. If you look at one of the things that the military has been doing, for example, is trying to increase both the amount of information they get, but also their ability to circulate the information that they process, right? So they have this sort of two-phase way of thinking about it. They get information, they process it, then they send it back out, right? That involves a delay, a temporal delay. And what they're attempting to do is they're trying to limit that delay as much as possible to make that stream as real-time as they possibly can, because it allows them to react as quickly as they can, right? And in a situation of mobile warfare, the ability to adapt quickly is the difference between victory and defeat, right? Winning and losing in a very immediate sense.
But as has been said too, it's like it seems like the processing of that information becomes pretty damn difficult. Even if you can keep the information flowing at a regular rate and real time, like processing it and being able to try to strategize onto what steps to take next.
Yeah, well, and it has to do, we talked about this in Insurgencies and a piece about the NSA. As you think about, you know, when you're pulling in 2 million text messages, like every hour, you're pulling in phone call data, you're pulling in email metadata, you're pulling in internet search string data. It's a lot. It's way more information than you could possibly hire enough people to process. And so what happens in that is there's filtering that goes on. With the NSA, they filter based on keywords, they filter based on, points of contact, right? Who's calling who, who's sending what, so on, so on, so on. Is the thing encrypted, right? And they toss out a lot of the rest. And in doing that, they make the volume of data more able to be dealt with. So for example, like, you might have 100,000 analysts, and that's the closest estimate, or at least the most consistent estimate of how many analysts work either on the payroll or by contract for the NSA, somewhere around 100,000. 100,000 analysts have a hard time processing data carefully without being given significant amounts of time to do so. And so, because you're not only thinking about data, but you have to put that data into a situational context, right? And that takes a lot of time. So I'm reading like maybe a week ago, even with the data that's been sort of filtered out, by all estimates, the NSA is something like a year behind the actual processing of data. And the more data that they collect, the less they have an ability to process it in a timely way, right? But if they weren't to collect it, their thinking is that they would miss something, right? This is, people forget the NSA is a military intelligence agency, right? It's not a law enforcement entity. And so there's this sense in which, at least with our use of technology, there has to be a balance that we can strike, right? No one knows where that balance is yet. But what's abundantly clear is, without the use of modern technology, without the use of laptops, without the use of cellular phones, without the use of being able to map out your movements as you're moving through space, the ability to do that is fictional, right? It's impossible to even conceive of. And so one of the things that we have to deal with is, you know, as people in the millennial generation, largely for a lot of us, finding information is not difficult, right? It's always out there. And it's about thinking through what is relevant information, what are we exactly trying to figure out, right? And having a little bit more organization in that process is the part that's proving a little difficult right now.
The most recent article on the blog for your think tank, for the Institute, talks about the strategies, as far as folks have been able to pin down, of ISIL or ISIS or IS.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can you talk about, like, what kind of research is going into the study of insurgent movements in different places? And has there been much study in terms of, say, what the Kurds in Rojava have been, how they've been organizing?
So when we're, the first kind of thing to outline is, when we're doing this kind of study, we're sort of making a methodological choice. And we talk about this in the piece we wrote about Syria, but also the piece that we just wrote about ISIS. We make a methodological choice, which is that we're not going to focus on the sort of stated conceptual politics of what's happening. We're merely going to focus on the actual tactical movements of what's happening. And if stated conceptual politics become a factor in that, then we'll mention that as well, right? But the primary discussion has to do with the tracking of material movements through space. And so to do that kind of research, it's really tedious. I think for the Syria piece, there was like 5 months of research put into it. And for the ISIS piece, there was another 5 months of research put into it. So a lot of these pieces, the information comes from doing things like tracking live blogs every day for months on end, like 4 or 5 live blogs, 6 sometimes. With the original Syria piece, it was like 12. And those live blogs usually become, because it's not even so much the blog itself as much as the comment stream kind of under it, where people are referencing different Twitter feeds, following those feeds, bouncing the ones that they're referencing to, and essentially tracking information back to original sources. And spending a lot of time doing that, spending maybe 3 hours a day for multiple months on end, tracking this stuff out, mapping it, taking a lot of notes, trying to watch certain tendencies occur over time, right? Which is why these reports tend to come out way later than what we're talking about, is we're trying to track this stuff over time. And really starting to understand things like the displacement of force in space, right? One of the common tendencies amongst both the Syrian insurgency and ISIS is to launch an attack somewhere else when they want to move into a second place, right, to draw a kind of oppositional force in one direction so they can move behind them. It's something that's like pretty commonly done, but done in very different ways, for example. with ISIS, there's a series of dynamics that have been kind of countervailing, specifically their attempt to organize a state, right, in this very formal sense. They have to hold space. They have to police that space. So like having to garrison soldiers in the place to actually patrol streets and things like that really prevents them from being able to exercise the mobility that they had exercised earlier. But to be able to see what the effects of that are took 2 months of studying what was going on in Raqqa every day and looking at what they were doing every day. Where were they directing traffic? What social services were they trying to run? Who are they like crucifying that day? Because they crucify a lot of people. Things like that. Right. What are the kind of underlying political dynamics on the ground and so on? And so in researching ISIS and kind of the Syrian insurgency, getting that information, though it takes a lot of digging, it's actually there. One of the hardest things about studying what's going on in, you know, what's loosely defined as kind of Kurdish autonomous areas, is the amount of information that gets out is much, much lower, right? There's just the amount of it isn't there. And often when information comes out, it's coming out in sort of article form. So you might have, you know, there's any number of blogs being maintained specifically in YPG kind of run areas in sort of north central Syria. But on those blogs, they might write about a whole event that happened over like 2 weeks. And so what happens in that is a lot of the information about the actual movements of actual bodies in space is lost, and kind of the narrative exists, right? So one of the things we've been trying to do, and this is, we're actually writing an update to the piece about ISIS for the blog about what happened in Kobani, which is in north central Syria. And to do that, we had to track down sources that hadn't been updating on the internet that might have written one thing. And we had to like track them down and send them emails and start to get a better understanding of what was happening on the ground, because a lot of those very immediate things weren't being updated as regularly or as widely. It was a little bit hard to track down that information. But the reason that we're doing that is we're trying to understand a series of dynamics and actual material conflict that, looking at sort of an American context, doesn't allow us to really start to gain a grasp on. Specifically what happens in moments of sort of extreme antagonism, right? What the relationship of movements and sort of force concentration are. These sorts of things that, you know, you're not going to really gain a good idea from by like studying Occupy or studying what's going on right now, or, you know, studying labor movements or something like that. Or even studying what happened in kind of a European context in Kiev or something. That there's an element of movement and speed here that's very profoundly different. And that's what's been motivating what we've been doing, and also generating a lot of the kind of methodological problems of actually studying a thing like this and having to stay up on it, and the kind of rigor that's involved in that.
Yeah, it sounds like a hell of a lot, and you sound a little bit tired
when
you're like, yeah, it takes so much work.
We're getting into talking about doing a series of other ones. Like I said, we're writing an update on Kobani right now, so I've been following that. The first two reports are going to come out in book form probably in March. So we've been thinking about how to talk about the methodology of how we did things. Yeah, it's exhausting work. It really is. We get done with one, and it finally goes through the edits, and our editorial process is pretty pretty intense. But once we get through all the edits, everyone sits down in whatever city they happen to be in, and we're kind of spaced out all over the place, sits down, takes a deep breath, and goes, oh, this is good. Okay, let's take a couple of weeks off, and like takes a couple of weeks off and sort of comes back, because it is a lot of work.
Why do you think it is that there's such a discrepancy between like the amount of information available concerning the movements of the YPG versus ISIS? Is it because there's so many like international eyes and media and governmental agencies that are focused on trying to combat or at least guess what the next move of ISIS is, versus or ISIS having a like regular Twitter feed and maybe YPG not?
I think it's all those things, but I think to understand that it requires making sense of the fundamentally different histories that are involved here. So even the Syrian insurgency, there's tons of Twitter feeds and things like that, right? And they came out of the sort of Arab awakening movements, right? This series of you know, insurgencies against central government authority that happened all over the place, outside of even Tunisia or Libya or something, but happened in smaller ways in a lot of other places, in which international attention was a major factor in the kind of geopolitics of what happened, right? And so from the very beginning, the second that they hit the street in Syria, there were reports and videos and all this stuff was going on all over the place. With ISIS, like their biggest kind of lifeline outside of, you know, stealing $2 billion from banks in Mosul, and the black market oil sales that they've been doing. Their biggest lifeline is foreign fighters. And so to be able to sustain that, they have to actually be putting out a lot of propaganda into the international sphere. One of the things we don't talk about in the report that we came across when we were doing research was really fascinating video in which ISIS fighters had just taken over a border checkpoint between Syria and Iraq. And the guy doing the video, the person speaking on the video, was actually a former Chilean history graduate student who was speaking in English, but very clearly also spoke Arabic. So he was trilingual, obviously very well educated, talking in great detail about the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which was this sort of treaty that was signed around World War I about how to break up the Middle East after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. And he's talking about the Sykes-Picot Agreement, kind of Western imperialism and the drawing of borders and so on, and like walking around and showing what equipment they had taken. He was able to name every single weapon, every single vehicle. And the video was really well made. And at the end of it, they blow up the prison at the border checkpoint. And there's three guys. One of them is chanting in German, one is chanting in French, and one's chanting in English. Right? And this was like 2 months. This video was made 2 months after the real kind of upsurge in ISIS activity. So they rely on international support. They rely not for money as much as for bodies, as for people. The difference is that sort of you take the YPG, and the YPG grows out of the PKK, right? But the PKK grows out of a larger Kurdish autonomous movement that's been going on since World War I. And so the communication networks in those movements tend to be, and in those kind of armed groups, right, specifically, and in the kind of political groups that they're attached to, tend to be very internalized, right? So the conversation tends to happen within those regions, between groups that exist in those regions. And so because the conversation's been going on for so long and it's been happening, I mean, what's been going on in that part of the world has been happening largely without international support, almost at all outside of Kurdish groups in Iraq who got U.S. support for years. But specifically groups that were active in Turkey and northern Syria, they've been pretty much operating without international support for a very long time. And so there's this sort of internalism to the way that they function and the way that communication occurs, which I'm starting to see a breakdown in that there's a lot more recognition of, you know, getting resources from the outside, for example, and like why that might be important at a point. And so there's more communication that's happening externally, but a lot of the communication for a very long time has been happening primarily on an internal basis. And again, that has a lot to do with the kind of links and trajectory of Kurdish uprisings in that part of the world.
There was a piece in the journal that specifically dealt with describing and breaking down failures, structural failures, philosophical failures, and just generalized failures, and interesting points about deep green resistance.
Yeah.
Would you be into talking about that really briefly? Because I thought the analysis was interesting.
Yeah. So I'll say caveat, I was not the primary author on that piece, but I like it and helped obviously with the proofreading and stuff. So that piece came out of a discussion we were having internally about, again, this kind of dichotomy that I was talking about earlier, between sort of this tendency to think of action between kind of the symbolic and then this kind of question of magnitude, right? So you look at your discussions around someone like Ted Kaczynski in the Anarchist Scene, right? And he's being seen as someone who like threw out pacifism and all these other things, and that's very true. He also failed really dramatically, right? And so what happens with something like deep green resistance, or what happens with that kind of discussion in the sort of eco-anarchist scene specifically, is this dichotomy that's being drawn sort of parallel to these other dichotomies in which action gets evaluated purely on the magnitude of what goes on, right, in this kind of inert space. And that gets fused with this kind of generalized symbolic understanding of quote-unquote industrial civilization, right? So there's this tendency within Deep Green Resistance to say, okay, well, there's industrial civilization exists this way, and it has an infrastructure, and we can map that infrastructure. And so therefore, the targets become infrastructural, right? I think the perfect analogy is one that they draw, right? That approach is one that they pull from, at least their understanding of, strategic bombing methodology from World War II, right? That they see everything from 30,000 feet. That there's this kind of map and these things on a map. And what they fail to recognize in that sort of approach, and this is an approach which you sometimes find in the animal liberation scene as well, what they fail to understand in that kind of an approach is every single thing that they identify as infrastructure has a sort of condition of possibility which in itself is not inert, whether that's economic, right, whether that's security-based, right, so on. And so when they develop these kind of inert strategies, which is something that, unfortunately, anarchists have a tendency to do, to start to think about what is the correct strategy in this kind of general circumstance. What they're doing is they're fundamentally misunderstanding what strategy is. Strategy is not an attempt to engage with an inert space. Strategy is an attempt to make sense of a dynamic situation, right? An attempt to take actions which are effective towards reaching an objective in a dynamic situation. So, for example, they don't account for very basic things, like what is the reaction of the state to whatever they're talking about infrastructurally. They don't compensate for these things because there's no way to. There's no way to know what that will be in some future moment. And so rather than recognizing the fallacy of the idea that there can be inert long-term strategies that never have to be revisited, they just ignore those problems entirely, right? And this is a problem that happened in Occupy. It's a problem that happened with the insurrectionist tendency in the U.S. I mean, we made that mistake. Started thinking about, you know, what is the right way to engage? And there wasn't this discussion of where we were, when we were, what we were trying to achieve. And when that discussion happened, it fundamentally broke down the idea that there was a right way to engage. And so what happens in Deep Green Resistance, and you can see this in the organization itself, kind of ossifying into this kind of proto-Leninist structure, is that they're attempting to make inert a situation which is fundamentally dynamic, right? Even in its sort of basic senses, right? We do things, those things have effects. It changes the terrain of engagement in every possible way, whether that's taking a single step or heartbeat or something like that, even in these very minor ways. Specifically in situations of intense conflict, the magnitude of that shift is much more pronounced, and it's something that they fail to take into account to the detriment of, and this is the whole thing. I mean, the point wasn't about, you know, destroying the idea of Deep Green Resistance. The point was about destroying the idea of inert strategy and trying to posit the beginning of a process of thinking about these things in very fluid and dynamic ways, rather than trying to ask the question, what is the correct strategy?
Really enjoyed the conversation. Thanks a lot for talking, Tom.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and I can't suggest enough that folks check out the writings. And where can they find the writings for the Institute?
ISIW.noblogs.org.
Cool.
And if we end up changing that to a more official website, we'll let people know.
Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF out of Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP out of Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP out of Columbus, Ohio. Archives of the show can be found a week after broadcast at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can contact us for critiques, criticisms at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net.